Welcome to Reading the Bible Together. I'm your host, Angela Smith.
Picturing where God is and what his purposes are is a lot like our own lives. It's not always that clear. Sometimes it's quite elusive. What path do we follow? And so a lot of times we make these snap judgments about people and things and ourselves. And so we're running on these snap judgments instead of like really taking time to slow down and say, okay, what is God saying to me? And one of the things he always uses is scripture to speak to you. So when we read these stories, we have to slow down and say, what is the storyteller saying or implying about God in this?
Unexpected. When you look in the lineage of Jesus, there are five women there that are unexpected, women you wouldn't think would be in the lineage of the Messiah. But they're there, and over the next few weeks, we're going to be taking a look at their stories. This episode, we're going to be talking about Tamar. You may have heard her pronounced Tamar. Today, we're going to be saying Tamar, just so you know. And we're talking about her story from Genesis 38, not to get confused with the Tamar that's in 2 Samuel 13. And I'm excited today when we were talking about this whole series and who we wanted to talk to about these different women in Jesus' lineage, when we talked about Tamar, Dr. Rebecca Ree was the first person that was suggested to us. She is a Bible scholar. She's a mom of a special needs child. And you can hear her regularly on Afternoons with Bill Arnold. You can also find out more at RebeccaRee.net, which will also be in the show notes. Welcome, Rebecca.
Well, thank you for having me.
So glad that you're here. So I'm getting started every episode asking all my guests, what's a favorite story you have from your own lineage or ancestors, since we're talking about Jesus's ancestry?
Well, one of the favorite stories that immediately came to mind is, so I have a German side of me, that's my mother, and I have a Chinese side to me from my father. And we're going to be talking about the German side. My German grandpa's name was Karl Heil, and he was not well-to-do. You know, every penny counted in his childhood growing up with the family. And one year when he was in grammar school, he had a crush on a girl named Erna Graupe. That's not a name you're about to forget.
Erna Graupe. That's a great name.
And as he told this tale to me, I was in college, and he actually closed his eyes, and he said, oh, I can still see her with her long blonde hair. So he asked his father, can I have a dime to buy Erna Graupe a Valentine? And the father, who was rather stern and practical, said, no, of course not. That's, you know, a waste of money. That's a lot of money for a Valentine. But his mother, who had more of a softer heart, said, oh, give the boy the dime. So he said, he watched as his father opened his wallet and, like, you know, very carefully counted out each penny that he gave him. And my grandfather went to go buy Erna Graupe the most elaborate tissue papered, you know, colorful, spectacular Valentine that he could find. And I said, you know, quite easily to my grandfather, well, what happened? What happened? And he said, oh, she rebuffed me. But I'll have to tell you this. I was sorry for him. But not so much, because he married my grandmother instead. But ever since then, when I was a young woman before I got married, he would mail me an elaborate heart-shaped box of chocolates on Valentine's Day. So he left me that legacy. And he left me with an image in my head, or a truth in my head, that, you know, as we are made in God's image, there is a logical and reasonable side to us, as represented by my grandfather's father, where we need to be practical. Mm-hmm. But there's also this generous, loving kindness kind of aspect to us that was represented by his mother. And those two things came together in this memory.
What a beautiful story. And you said, you know, you're glad that he didn't marry the one little girl, because then he went on to marry your grandmother. And,
yes,
you know, that reminds me of, you know, Tamar's story and what we're seeing in her story and how she really had to fight for, you know, the lineage of Jesus. You know, it can get overwhelming to think about God's plan, and that God has, you know, is a God of details and lineage, and can use people who, you know, might not be, like, you know, sparkly and cleaned up the best, but, you know, the way that he can work things in the way that will follow his plan. Would you give us a little bit of a synopsis of Tamar, in case someone's not heard her story, to make sure that we're all talking about the same Tamar? We give us a little synopsis of her story.
Sure. I'd give you the 1 minute synopsis, which is Tamar was married into the family of Judah, who's the son of Jacob, who's the son of Isaac, and who's the son of Abraham. So she comes from a very elite family of promise. She's in the family of promise line. And her first husband, who's Judah's firstborn son, is evil. We're not told how, and he is put to death by God. Then his brother is told by Judah, go into your brother's wife and impregnate her and raise up children for your dead brother's name. This was called levirate marriage. You can find it in Deuteronomy and also in Ruth. And it was a way of preserving a person's legacy and their name. So Onan's evil, although we don't know what his brother did, Onan's evil was to waste his seed upon the ground whenever he went into Tamar. And this was a nasty secret thing that he was doing to deny and cheat her of her rights as a member of Judah's family. And God saw this evil and put Onan to death as well. So then Judah didn't want to give his last remaining son to Tamar because he was figuring that the blame was hers because she wasn't able to say anything. So he said he banished her from the family, said, go back to your father's house, be a widow. And when my last son grows up, I'll give him to you. But he didn't really have any intentions of doing that because when the time comes, he doesn't. So Tamar has to, she's fallen this meteoric fall from being married to the firstborn son in a family, which would be afforded her some, you know, social stability, some financial stability. And she has to figure out a way to get the offspring that are hers. She has to figure out a way to get back into the Abrahamic line of succession. So she dresses herself up as a harlot, and she sits at the gate of Enaim, and that name in Hebrew means eyes. It's very interesting that she is trying to control others. That's metaphorical. She's trying to control how other people see her, when all up to this point, everybody has misperceived her as evil, and she's had no control over that. So she dresses up as a harlot, has this encounter with her father-in-law, and then goes away, and he goes his way. But she retains from him his rod, his staff, and his cord, which are identifying marks that a man like Judah would have had in the ancient world. It's basically like your license and your credit cards.
Okay.
So they separate. The family 3 months later comes back and says, hey, your daughter-in-law is pregnant, and she was immoral. She got this way immorally. And so he just summarily says, well, burn her. Just very casually, just burn her to death. And as she's coming and they're getting ready to execute her, she produces these licenses and credit cards. And she says, by the man who owns these, I am pregnant. And that's when Judah gives the all important statement, she is righteous, not I. Mm-hmm. And so he exonerates Tamar, and those babies are, she's saved. The babies are saved from being burned. And eventually at the end of the story, we learn that not only has she been blessed with a pregnancy after just one encounter, she's blessed with twins. And their names are Zerah and Perez. And that's how we know that this amazing, not only is she brought back into the lineage of Abraham, but she's doubly blessed in this sense.
Well, and what's interesting is that when Judah says that Tamar should be burned, he's also unknowingly going to, you know, break his lineage once again.
Right. He is unknowingly burning his own children.
Wow.
After wanting to protect his last son from Tamar, which is ironic because, like, she wasn't the cause of death, but here he is ready to impose death on his own two children.
So will you talk about, because she poses as a harlot, as a prostitute, and, you know, and then he calls her righteous. You know, in today's culture, if we were to look at someone that would do that, righteous might not be the word that we would use to describe them. What was it in the cultural moment then that this was what she was supposed to do and what she did was right?
Well, okay, so two things I would say. The first thing I would say is this. When we read, my area of expertise is Hebrew narrative, so I look at a lot of storytelling. And the first thing I want to always ask is, how is the storyteller approaching the issue at hand. When characters color outside the lines, we're not sure, you know, is that there's a question we can ask. Is what this person doing descriptive or prescriptive? So descriptive means it's just a description of what someone is doing for a certain purpose. Prescriptive means like a doctor writes you a prescription, meaning it's a kind of statement saying, well, we should all follow this example and do the same thing. Now, in this story, I would say we're getting a descriptive story, a descriptive narrative here. And we have to really consider, does the story anywhere outright condemn her the way the story condemns Er and Onan, the two brothers that were put together for their evil by God? So the storyteller is well able to say something clearly when a character is acting in an evil manner. And he does not say this about Tamar. Instead, what happens is they have one encounter. I call it the one and done. And miraculously, she gets two babies in the line of Judah from this one encounter. So it just seems like, and not only that, she gets a pronouncement from the Lion of Judah, Judah's was the scepter shall not depart from Judah's hand. She gets this exoneration statement. She is more righteous than I. That's a legal statement. You can probably say he's trying to exonerate her before the whole family and says, she is not to be punished for this. I am responsible for this. And the story also includes the little detail that after he makes the statement, he never has sexual relations with her again. So that's also a very strong statement. Realize he's taking responsibility, saying, you know, this is where I stepped outside the line. She was doing what she needed to do, but I'm not going to step outside the line again because I recognized it was a desperate measure by her.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's interesting, just her story, how she's married to the firstborn son, which is a prestigious place to be.
Right.
You know, falls and is banished and then comes back and then produces the firstborn son.
Right.
Which is amazing.
One very interesting thing about that firstborn son, there's a little story at the very end of Tamar's story, which is this. She's giving birth to twins. One starts to come out. His name is Zerah. And the midwife ties a red thread around him and says, you came out first. But then he pulls his arm back in and his brother, Perez, bursts out first. And why would they include this little detail at the very end? Well, what it turns out is in the story of Jacob, when he is having that dream of the ladder going up and down to heaven, and God introduces himself to him and says, I'm going to be with you, and your seed is going to burst forth to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west. That verb, burst forth, is padat. And then the son that bursts forth from Tamar, he fights his way out. His name is Paretz. In the Hebrew, it's the same verb, which means to say that we see in flesh and blood in Tamar's life the fulfillment of what was being said to Jacob way back when. So God is including her in the family of Abraham, in that precious Abrahamic seed that by whom the whole world is supposed to be blessed.
That's amazing. And then we see her again in Matthew 1:3 when Matthew is writing out the lineage of Jesus. That's where you can see her. Yes. Judah, the son, the father of Perez, and Zerah. Is that how you say it?
Yep, Zerah. Yep.
Whose mother is Tamar. So, you know, what are some of the things that we can wrestle with in this? You know, I feel like when we interact with Scripture, sometimes it's easy to just kind of read over things and not really take it to heart. But sometimes I think there are things that we need to wrestle with in our own life.
Yes. So one of the things that amazes me about Tamar is she perseveres. I mean, she might be the person that perseveres the most in the Bible top five, let's say, that I know of. And, she perseveres in the shadow. All these horrible things are happening to her. She's just falling and falling and falling from one station to the next, lower and lower. And she does not give up. And something about it, even though it doesn't directly say so, something says to me that she does not choose to regard herself as a victim. She continues to persevere and say, what can I do about this? So she takes risks. she takes a veil and she puts it over her head, and her whole gambit with Judah as posing as a harlot rests on this veil remaining in place, and her sitting at that gate of the eyes, that he will perceive her there and engage her, and her using her voice for the first time to speak up and barter with Judah so that she can have this encounter with him. All of these are risks that are life and death risks, as we can see in the story. So that would make us decide, ask ourselves, is there any risk that we might, you know, are we putting it all on the line for the things that we know God has for us? She knows that she's supposed to have these Abrahamic offspring. She knows this and knows this, and she puts this all, everything she has on the line for that. And I would say, what are we doing? Is there a risk God is asking us to take and trust him?
Well, and she very firmly knew, like you were saying, her identity. She knew what she was, who she was. She knew what her purpose was. And one thing that stood out to me in the story is when she, when he propositions her, she says, you know, what will you give me? And he says, a goat. And she says, well, until I get the goat, I want these things from you, which I thought that was pretty bold.
Yes. And it was, in fact, those very things that saved her life and the life of her babies.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite things from her, from the story of Tamar?
The things I like the most about Tamar, and it's the thing that I'm going to be studying with a bunch of other women that I actually talked about with Bill Arnold before, is this. A lot of times the storyteller will tell you outright, and, you know, and God was pleased with so-and-so, and so God did this for so-and-so. But a lot of the time, picturing where God is and what his purposes are is a lot like our own lives. It's not always that clear. Sometimes it's quite elusive. What path do we follow? And so, and a lot of times we make these snap judgments about people and things and ourselves. And so we're running on these snap judgments instead of like really taking time to slow down and say, okay, what is God saying to me? And one of the things he always uses is scripture to speak to you. So when we read these stories, we have to slow down and say, what is the storyteller saying or implying about God in this? And so the fact that God helps Tamar conceive after only one encounter, the fact that he gives her twins, the fact that the firstborn is not the Zerah, but Parat, and it becomes the fulfillment of the promise made to Jacob. These are all signs that God is, in fact, supporting her. There's a verse in Chronicles that talks about God's eyes rove to and from over the earth, looking for to support those who are strongly support those who are his. So, and also Judah's pronouncement of him saying, she's the one that's righteous, not me. So, all these things come together. The storyteller is trying to craft a message of God is behind the scenes and she is collaborating with him. That's what I love about her, is that she seems to have this amazing sensitivity to the movement of divine efforts and collaborate with them so that the outcome is nothing she would ever have imagined and is amazing and life-giving.
Well, and I love what we learn about God, you know, what you were talking about, that he is able to, that he's using her and blessing her. Are there other things that you feel like where we can learn about God from her story?
Yeah, it reminded me of that passage when Jesus, the Pharisees bring the woman caught in the act of adultery and throw her at the feet of Jesus. And he seems totally uninterested in condemning her. And so I think that's another thing that we need to learn, which is when we're reading these stories and when we're reading the stories of the lives around us, you know, the living stories of those around us who have gone through hardship, who are facing these meteoric falls of their own, or maybe even judging ourselves when we've had a bad fall, that we have to realize God's interest is not in condemning us. You know, he's there like Jesus was, drawing in the sand, waiting for everybody to disappear to ask us the vital question, did no one condemn you? You know, go and sin no more. So that's something I learned about God, was that we have to sit and think about having a more patient, informed, and nuanced point of view when we read these stories and when we look at other people and look at ourselves.
Yeah, that's interesting that you said that, because when I was describing Tamar at the beginning and her being a prostitute and the cultural differences, as I was talking about the way that we would describe a prostitute today, I got really checked kind of in my soul of, you know, maybe I shouldn't be condemning someone who's working as a prostitute today, because I don't know their story. I don't know what brought them there. And so I just want to acknowledge that even though my question before, I would like to reframe that it's, we should offer more compassion and understanding and listen. I mean, it's amazing what we learn from people when we really listen. You know, if someone would have taken a moment and listened to Tamar and heard her where she was coming from and, you know, what had been happening to her, things would have been different, and she probably wouldn't have had to go to the lengths that she had gone to if someone had just listened to her.
Yes. Well, I find as I study stories about women in the Bible, often they are pressed into these really difficult circumstances where their body becomes the only currency they have to get where they need to go. And so that we certainly see that, you know, what resources did she have at her command? Not much.
Right.
So she used it. But, you know, the thing that we should take away that is the prescriptive statement is, are we ready to put it all on the line for God, for the thing he's calling us to do, for the thing we know he's calling us to do? That's what it boils down to.
Is there anything else you want to make sure we talk about with Tamar and her story?
I think just keep reading it and keep reading it, and notice how she starts in the shadows and she steps into the light eventually, and she doesn't give up until the good is won. And that is what, more than human blood, that is the trajectory of Jesus's life, that he comes from a very high place, puts on the clothes, not of harlotry, but puts on the clothes of humanity, and operates very in obscurity until it's his time to step into the light and accomplish his Father's will.
That's such a good story, and so much that we can learn from it. Thank you, Dr. Rebecca Ree, for taking the time and partnering with us in this and sharing with us all that you've learned. Or not all. That wouldn't all fit in this amount of time, but some of what you've learned about Tamar's story. Thank you so much.
You're very, very welcome. I love Tamar.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Rebecca Ree as much as I did. So many great insights into Tamar and the time in which she was living, and, you know, offering some perspectives on her story. I love that storyteller, you know, angle that she was talking about too, the questions that we can ask ourselves. I didn't share any of my family stories with you, and I would love to do that. So my mom's mom and dad were married and lived out just outside of Chicago. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, worked in a Western Union, and this was during the Depression. And so times were hard and they didn't have a lot of money. And there was a customer that would come into the bank, and it was a man, and apparently he loved my grandmother's smile. And so when he came in and he needed some Western Union, some banking business to be done, he would go to her window. And when he was done, he would flip a silver dollar to her, which was a lot of money during the Depression. And then she didn't know who he was, but she came to find out later it was Al Capone. Crazy, right? So crazy. Al Capone was giving my grandmother silver dollars. Thank you for joining us for this conversation about Tamar, one of the unexpected women in the lineage of Jesus. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes. If you want to get your hands on that study guide, you can do that over at myfaithradio.com. We'll see you next time for our conversation about the story of Rahab.
The Reading the Bible Together podcast is a production of Faith Radio and Northwestern Media. Hosted, produced, and edited by Angela Smith. If you've enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more, consider financially supporting Faith Radio. Find more information at myfaithradio.com.